Shall we get started then? So, there's been a couple of lessons or a couple of weeks since our last lesson, so I think we should go back over some of the things we've already talked about. So let's do some review. The first premise of this course that we sought to establish, the first few lessons were dedicated to proving the statement that God causes evil. And I believe we did that. So that the statement that God causes evil or actively is bringing evil about brings immediately to the forefront of our minds the problem of evil, which is if God is causing evil, how is he not responsible for it, right? So we have to have an answer of how God can be responsible or not responsible when he is in fact causing evil. And the answer to that is that if you think about the nature of God as being a supreme being, you realize that God is above the law, that if he were under the law, he would not be a supreme being. So as Christians, we have to accept the fact that God is above the law. In other words, he does what he wants, and he's not responsible because there is no law or lawgiver above him telling him what he can do or can't do or holding him responsible for what he does. Then as a corollary to that, last time, we discuss the idea that guilt before God is ultimately based on God's sovereign choice to hold a man responsible, as opposed to the idea that there's something in the human himself that is the grounds for guilt, such that God can't hold a man responsible unless certain conditions are met. If God creates justice and creates law, then there is no standard above him, then we can't say that God needs any reason in the creature. He can do what he wants, and he can hold you responsible. If he says you're responsible, and there is no appeals process from there on out. So the goal of lessons 7 and 8 is to defend the statement, atonement and original sin are just, in light of this proposed solution to the problem of evil. So in light of the idea that God is above the law, how does this relate to defending the statements that atonement and original sin are just? We have to accept, for instance, that atonement is just because God says he's just and the justifier. It's not as if he just decided he's not going to be just, but he is just, so we have to defend this statement. Last time, I kind of left off with this idea that traditional Calvinism has often failed to explain the justice of atonement and original sin because it has refused to discard human freedom or ability as fundamental to guilt. And if you accept that something in the person himself is the basis of guilt, you have a very difficult time understanding how guilt could be transferred, because what's innate in me as the basis for responsibility is not going to be in somebody else. So it creates a very big problem in explaining how these transfers of guilt are just. It's my proposal that we get rid of that idea, that those things are not fundamental to guilt at all, but rather God's sovereign choice. So we come then in this lesson to the doctrine of original sin. And the first thing to do is to explain what it is, and the second thing to do is to show that it's just. So there's a number of different ways of thinking about this, but before we get to those, I want to make a few preliminary remarks. And the first thing is that these words are not the same thing. Transgression, guilt, punishment, and corruption are all different aspects of sin, and none of them mean the same thing. So the transgression is the actual breaking of the law, right? That's the active sin. You don't become a sinner without transgressing the law. Once you've transgressed the law, the guilt is a result of a judgment of God against you. So the guilt is a judgment, something that God says, now you're guilty, I'm holding you responsible for breaking that law. So transgression, the guilt that comes from it, on the basis of the guilt, then you have a punishment inflicted on you. That might be an eternity in hell, it might be something else, but you have a punishment. That's kind of the process of a sin. Then you have this other idea of corruption or depravity. So depravity is a corruption of your nature, which then causes you to actively sin. So in a sense, corruption you might consider as before all these other three. It's something that causes you to sin, but it's not an active sin in and of itself. Corruption is not breaking a law. Corruption is the, you know, corruption of your mind and will that would cause you to break a law. So is the distinction between all four of those clear? Because this is kind of the basis. Understanding these distinctions help us to understand what original sin is and what a transfer of guilt would be. When we say a transfer of guilt, we're talking that number two is transferred, not number one. Transgression is not transferred. Even if, you know, Adam was the only one who sinned, but his guilt comes upon all men, and as a result, his punishment. If we're clear on that, second point is that the idea of the imputation of sin, so we say that Adam's sin is imputed to us. The imputation of sin, to say that, is equivalent to saying that his guilt is attached to us. So imputation is the idea of a guilt being attached to somebody. If you, you know, this could be if you even just did a sin yourself. If you killed somebody, murdered somebody, that sin would be imputed to you, or you would be held responsible. That's just all that imputation means. Yes.
Transgression is the actual sin, and it's not equal to guilt, then does it stand that imputation of sin is the same as the attachment of guilt?
Right, so if you transgress the law but the transgression was not imputed to you, then you wouldn't be guilty. Just like we actually do our transgressions, but our sins are imputed to Christ, meaning he is held responsible, not that he is thought to have actually done them. You know, God's not confused about who actually did the sin. Just like it says Christ was made sin for us, it doesn't mean that he actually did the sins, only that the sins are imputed to him. Okay, so keep these things in mind as we go forward. The main text, yeah.
The first point, transgression does not equal guilt. I think that's another, perhaps, failure in our modern Christianity, because we do connect those two, and we don't believe in the idea of inherited guilt, and so we really think that we're a sinner because we sin, when actually it's kind of opposite of that. We sin because we're already guilty. We're already a sinner as soon as we were born,
right?
And so it doesn't seem fair, but that's of course what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And if we get, I mean, we've got to understand that, and I don't understand how this all works necessarily, but we've got to understand that we have inherited guilt from Adam.
Right. The concepts, at least, are different. Even if you would deny that guilt ever comes without an actual transgression, the Bible does deny that, but...
There's a transgression somewhere if there's guilt.
Yeah, right.
Somewhere.
There's a transgression somewhere, but the transgression is a different thing than the guilt. They're separate concepts, and we just need to keep them separate, or else we become very confused in our discussions about this. So, Romans 5, 12 through 19 is the primary text on the relationship between us and Adam. That's the primary place where we get that, where we get information about that from the Bible. So what it says here is in verse 12, the beginning, it says, "Wherefore, as by one man sin entered the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned." Now, what everybody agrees on in this verse is that in some way the universality of death is a result of Adam's sin. Everybody dies as a result of Adam's sin. You can't get around that because it says, by one man sin entered the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men. There's some sort of causal relationship between the first sin and everybody's death. The question is, what's the relationship? And there's three views on that. So what we're going to look at now is three views of the different of the relationship between the first sin and everybody's death. The question is, how is it that death is a universal result of Adam's sin? So there's three views here. The first is that Adam's sin is the occasional cause of everybody else's sin and death. Secondly, that there's immediate cause in between Adam's sin, and I'll explain this in a minute, but there's immediate causation between Adam's sin and our death. And the third is that Adam's sin is the immediate cause, or the his sin is directly imputed to us such that we're actually responsible for it. Okay, so let's drill into these a little bit more. This view, this first one is the Pelagian view, that Adam's sin is the occasional cause of all men's death. So, all men follow Adam's example. Adam produced circumstances which make it almost certain that his descendants will choose to sin. And if they choose to sin, then they're going to die on the basis of their own sins, right? So Adam's a sinner. His children, say Cain, grows up in a sinful family, so he kind of follows his dad's example and sins on his own, and then on the basis of that sin, he dies. And according to the Pelagianism, this is the only relationship between us and Adam in terms of our sin. Okay? Second one. Because of Adam's sin, his nature was corrupted. The corruption was transmitted to his descendants. The corruption causes men to sin, and because of these actual sins, men are guilty and are punished. So you see, we have an intermediate causal factor here of corruption. So Adam's sin doesn't directly cause us to sin and be punished, but it directly causes corruption, and then the corruption, which is transmitted to us through natural generation, is what causes us to sin. So do you see how that's an immediate cause? So it's kind of a three-step process. Adam sins, then the corruption is transmitted, the depravity is transmitted to his children, and then his children sin on the basis of that depravity. But notice here, we're not responsible for Adam's sin. We're still only responsible for our own sins. And then lastly, immediate causation or direct imputation. All of Adam's descendants are held responsible or are guilty of Adam's first sin. In other words, even if a hypothetical person did no actual sin, then he would still be responsible for Adam's sin and still could be sent to hell on the basis of Adam's sin. That's what this view would hold to. So the question is, which one of these is true? Which one of these then can provide an explanation of Romans 5? So we go back to Romans 5:12. If you take the Pelagian view, this is how you would read this verse. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, because all have sinned. All have actually sinned in following Adam's example, right? So the universality of death is based on the universality of active transgressions of people. People are still only being killed for what they actually did. If you take the second view of immediate causation through the idea of corruption, you're going to read sin here as the idea of not actively sinning but becoming corrupt. So here's how you would read it. Wherefore, as by one man corruption entered the world, and death by corruption, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have become corrupt. And so you interpret the idea of sin as the idea of corruption. If you take the last view, the sin is immediately imputed, you would read it this way. As by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so death passed upon all men, for that all have representatively sinned in Adam. So we have the idea of all people sinning, but they did it representatively, not in their actual person, but because Adam was their representative. So you can see all these have a fairly decent interpretation of this verse 12. If all we have was verse 12, it would be difficult to determine which one's right. What we have to do is see which of these can account for the rest of the passage. So we look at the rest of the passage, say, what are the arguments, what's being said here, and then we can use that to reinterpret verse 12. Does that make sense? Does kind of the three views make sense to everybody? Okay, so let's go to the next couple verses here. Verses 13 and 14. So, it starts out, notice verse 13 starts out with the word for. That indicates we've got an argument in support of verse 12. So whatever verse 12 is teaching, we've now got an argument proving that. So the question is, what does the contents of verse 13 and 14 prove? Whichever view it proves validly, you know, that would be the view that we have to take. Now, I'm going to read these and then I'll comment. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned, after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him that was to come. The exact meaning, especially of verse 13, the exact argument, is somewhat difficult to pin down. I'm going to say that from the outset. It's a little bit difficult. There's two different interpretations that I vacillate between them. I'm just going to give them to you. I'm not sure which one is right. The first is that what Paul is arguing in verse 13 is that even though the law of Moses was not before Moses, even though we didn't have the law of Moses, there still was a law, and people were still actively sinning. So it says, "For until the law, sin was in the world. There was sin, but we already know that sin is not imputed when there is no law, or there is no sin when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses." So we know that there must have been a law, right? According to that. So the argument then would be, we know there was a law that people were actually actively breaking. Nevertheless, in opposition to that, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression. People were actively sinning, but not everybody was actively sinning. There were some people that didn't sin like Adam, and so that's the explanation of his argument. The other view is to say that there's actually two arguments here. One is the argument that the law of Moses does not account for the universality of death, and the second is that there's some people that don't break any law at all. So the interpretation then would be, for until the law of Moses, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed where there is no law. Therefore, nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, meaning that people were dying even without the law of Moses. So we know that the law of Moses can't be the explanation for the universality of death. And then he gives argument two, that it was that even people were dying who hadn't sinned against any law, who hadn't sinned in any way after the similitude of Adam's transgression. Whichever argument or interpretation you take there, one thing is clear. Paul is pointing out that the people that came after Adam were different, had not sinned according to the similitude of Adam's transgression. They had not sinned in the same way that he did, and yet they were accounted to be sinners. So how does this work? If you take the first view, the Pelagian view, why would he be arguing? What he would want to argue is that all men have sinned like Adam did, right? That's what you would want to prove if you take the Pelagian interpretation. That's not here. Whatever he's arguing here, he's certainly not arguing that. What if you take the second view, the idea of corruption? So then you would say that what Paul is proving here is that people die even though they didn't actually sin actively. What they would say then is that people are being put to death based on this corruption. So what Paul is proving is that people are dying based on the corruption without the actual sin. Bear with me, I know this is a little bit technical, but this second view makes a lot better sense of the logic. Like, you still have it seems like a logical argument, because he's proving that corruption is the basis of death, not active sin. But you have another problem. You have two problems, and they're terminology problems. According to this interpretation, sin in verse 12 means corruption. Sin in verses 13 and 14 means active, actual sin. Do you see that? You're changing the meaning of the word sin, but there doesn't seem to be a justifiable reason for doing that. You know, this is an argument in support of the premise. Wouldn't you use the same terms in your argument that you use in your premise? The second problem is that the word sinned, that verb, all have sinned, it never means all have become depraved or all are corrupt. It just doesn't mean that. It always, if you look it up in the Bible, it always refers to an act of sin. So this view is forced, at the very least. You're just twisting words to make it mean what you want to mean. The natural interpretation of this is to say that all have sinned representatively in Adam. He's trying to say in verse 12 that on the basis of one man, all die. That's the main point. And the reason for that is because all have sinned representatively, and the proof of that is that there are people that are dying, you know, for example, infants, that are not sinning like Adam did. So we must have some other sin, some other that is the basis outside of the person himself for the guilt that is being laid upon people. And according to Paul, that is the one sin of Adam, that we all sinned representatively in Adam. I think right out the door, you know, the idea of representation of a representative sin or an immediate imputation of sin is really the only one that makes sense here. Does anyone want to talk about this? I know that was a little bit technical. Does anyone have anything they want to say before we move on? I think the problems only get worse as we go forward. I mean, not in terms of complexity, but in terms of for the other views.
I guess I see the first. I guess the first two views of Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism. Is that accurate?
I guess you would call it.
I guess what I'm thinking is if you hold the second view, I may be being too simplistic on this. Seems to me if you hold the second view, you might as well hold the first one. Because in both cases, what we're really going against the idea here is that if I, this is the challenge. I am not guilty if I haven't done it.
Right. Right.
And I don't. And I believe that's what the Bible teaches. Mm-hmm. And I think the first two views sort of dives that in the same way.
Right. They want to make you guilty for your actual sins.
Right. Right.
If you notice, though, when it actually started working out in the interpretation of this passage, the corruption idea, we started to say that men are being killed, are being put to death on the basis of their corruption and not actual sin anyway. And
so,
yeah,
so it sounds the same.
I think what you're saying is right. If you're going to go that way, you might as well just go the whole way and say that we're being killed for Adam's sin, just flat out.
Yeah.
Like, you're not really solving anything.
That's what seems.
But it seems a little more palatable that,
right.
That you know, I'm born that way, so, you know, even though I didn't have any choice, well, maybe I just am that way, so, I don't know. It seems a little bit better than just saying, regardless of who I am, I'm going to be guilty. But it does. You might say philosophically it doesn't solve any of the problems any better.
And I think mostly that's because you end up with the argument about babies,
right,
who haven't had time to transgress.
Right.
You can argue that every person, baby through 90-year-old, is corrupt, and that the corruption makes it inevitable that they will have sinned when they're able to do something. A baby hasn't had time to do anything.
You think about a baby in the womb. There's not only is there not a possibility of sin, there's not a possibility of someone to sin against. Like, it can do whatever it wants in there. It can't hurt anybody.
Right. And if there's no thought going on.
Right.
There's no, even in your mind. So the problem ends up being that because there are exceptions, you can't make a person out of it.
Right. Yeah. One thing I'll just note here in passing is that in the view of immediate imputation that I'm arguing for, corruption is part of death. So corruption, the depravity, is a curse of Adam's sin that is put on his race as a result of the guilt being put on their race. So in that way, it differs from the other view, which says that the immediate imputation view says that depravity is a natural result of Adam's sin, but it's not a penal infliction. It's not a punishment. According to the immediate imputation view, sin is corruption is part of the death that is inflicted on all Adam's descendants. We are corrupt. Our natures are corrupted. Anyway, so we have the argument in support of verse 12. Now we have, so the point, I should mention, at the end of verse 14, you see the main point of the passage there, who is the figure of him that was to come. So we're drawing an analogy between Adam and Christ. Before we get to that, though, Paul gives us some dissimilarities. Before he says the similarity, he gives us some dissimilarities. So here's what he says in verse 15. But not as the offense, so also as the free gift. So there's a difference here. For if, through the offense of one, many be dead, much more the grace of God and the gift by grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded unto many. Now, we're not going to get too much into this, but just notice the phrase there, through the offense of one, many be dead. He puts those two together. You know, if you take the corruption view, that there's an intermediate cause between the offense and the death, and that would be corruption, then, you know, why wouldn't he have said that on the basis of, you know, through the corruption of many, you know, many be dead, or through the, even the corruption of one, many be dead. But no, he says the offense. So he seems to be, you know, putting a causal relationship there between the offense and the death of everyone. But moving on, maybe you can get around that one. And not as it was, verse 16, and not as it was by one that sinned, so is the free gift. So another dissimilarity here. For the judgment was by one to condemnation, but the free gift is of many offenses unto justification. So one question here is, what's the one in the first clause there? The judgment was by one. Well, we have to take it as parallel. The one is in parallel to the many in the next clause, right? It's the one versus the many. So in the second clause, it's said that it's many offenses. So we know that it's the one offense in the first clause. Okay, so here's what it says then. The judgment, that would be the judgment of God, of guilt, the judgment was by one to condemnation, by one offense. In other words, what meaning of by do you have if it's not on the, if a judgment is not on the basis of that? So the judgment is on the basis of one offense, and the judgment is condemnation or guilt. And that's in opposition to the idea that that grace, or God's grace, redeems us from many offenses unto justification, from our actual sins as well as this one initial sin. If Paul was trying to express immediate imputation, it would be hard for him to do it in a much clearer way. It seems very clear in just the words themselves. Verse 17 then, for if by one man's offense death reigned by one, much more they which receive the abundance of grace and the gift of righteousness shall reign in life by one, Jesus Christ. So, again, we have that, you know, that juxtaposition of the offense and the death. They're just put together as if one is the direct cause of the other. And that seems to be what Paul is indicating, that we all die on the basis of that one initial sin, or that one initial offense. So I think that, you know, this part of the passage, we really start to the other views really start to run against the rocks. There's just, why would he be arguing the way he's arguing here and saying the things he's saying if what he wanted us to believe was that it was that the judgment was on the basis of many offenses to condemnation? That's what the Pelagian view would say. He should be saying the judgment was on the, in verse 16, the judgment was by many offenses to condemnation, but the free gift is of many offenses to justification. That would be the parallel. But that's not what he says here. And he shouldn't be saying, if we take the second view, the immediate view of corruption, then he should be saying the judgment was by one corruption to condemnation. But he says the judgment was by one offense. So really, they really run against the rocks here. Anyone want to dialogue about this slide or this part of the chapter before we move on? So here's where we get the full analogy then. This is the verse 12 started an analogy. It said, as by one man sin entered into the world, etc. But it never said what it was as. It never said the other part of the analogy. Well, here's where we get it. So, therefore, as by the offense of one, judgment came upon all men to condemnation, even so by the righteousness of one, the free gift came upon all men unto justification of life. So again, the words themselves. The offense of one, judgment came by the offense of one. Very clear. Again, very, very clear. But we have another issue here. This is interesting. It says, in the same way, these two things, original sin and justification, happen in the same way. As by the offense of one, judgment came upon all men, even so, in the same way, by the righteousness of one, the free gift came upon all men to justification. If you say that, let's take that the middle view, that corruption is the basis here, then what Paul must be arguing here is that, you know, the corruption comes upon all men, and then they're sinful on the basis of their own sins. In the same way, you know, the righteousness, the free gift must be a regeneration and making you inherently good. It must be justification must be a basis on the basis of us becoming inherently good and as a result doing good works. That's the Roman Catholic view, essentially. We already know from the book of Romans that Paul has made a great point of emphasizing justification is on the basis of grace, not of works. Not of works. He says that all the time. Why would he be, what is the parallel here that he's trying to make if justification is an external righteousness, but our condemnation comes by an internal sin, then what's the parallel? How are they the same at all? They're completely different. So, in order to preserve this parallel, we have to admit the external righteousness of Christ and the external sin of Adam as being the basis of our justification and our condemnation. And in that context, we then see verse 19, which makes everything very clear. For as by the disobedience, as by one man's disobedience, many were constituted or made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous. It's very clear that the basis of our guilt and the basis of our righteousness are external to us. We have nothing to do with the fundamentally the reason we are guilty and the reason we are righteous. They are things that we get from our representative heads of Adam and Christ. This appears to me to be the plain meaning of these words. We're not like reading anything in here. This is what Paul is saying. So I would submit to you on the basis of that immediate cause or immediate or direct imputation of Adam's sin, or the idea that we sinned representatively in Adam, is the only possible interpretation of Romans 5. Is that convincing, or is...
Yeah, it is.
Are there any lingering doubts?
I mean, you made the case. If our justification is external, then how can you say it's unjust if our condemnation is also external?
Right.
I don't see how you can do that.
Yeah. Either you have to say, if you accept Pelagianism in original sin, you have to accept a corresponding Pelagianism in salvation.
And that's what they ultimately do.
Mm-hmm. Very true. And if you, you know, same with...
You mentioned the Roman Catholic view. I mean, that is... You know, Christ, as I understand Roman Catholicism, Christ doesn't save; he makes salvation sort of possible,
right?
Which you kind of make it actual,
right? It is on the basis ultimately of your own righteousness, on the basis of which happens because you're made inherently morally good,
right?
And then once you're actually good, then you get the judgment of justification
right.
upon you.
Right. If you're I don't know. The only thing I don't know about Roman Catholicism, do you ever make it directly to heaven, or does everybody go to purgatory? I don't know.
I think some people get directly.
Maybe the saints.
I don't know. Pope.
That's the last guy. I don't know, anyways.
Okay, so two questions come immediately to our minds when we assert this view of original sin. Why do we get Adam's first sin and not Cain's or Seth's sin? Why is it that one? And why, by the way, do we only get the first one and not all the rest? Because Adam certainly did more than just one sin. And then secondly, and perhaps more importantly, how is it just? How is this at all justice for me, who had nothing to do with what happened back in the garden, to be held responsible for that sin? Well, here's one thing that's thrown out sometimes. Could it be... because we are Adam's natural descendants. Does that explain original sin? Well, not really. For one, if it's just on the basis of natural propagation, shouldn't we get all Adam's sins and all our ancestors' sins? You know, what about all the other ancestors that we have? It doesn't seem to make any sense at all. And also, it doesn't really explain the justice. Why am I getting judged because of something my parents did? It just doesn't give an explanation for that. Okay, here's a partial solution. The relationship described in Romans 5 seems to be that of legal representation. Adam and Christ are legal representatives, just like I would hire a lawyer, retain a lawyer. I sign a contract with him and his actions, I'm considered responsible for his actions. That seems to be the relationship that is being described here. Okay, so how do I get a legal representative? Well, generally, it's by signing a contract, right? Or there's a covenant or a contract between you and the representative. So another way of thinking about this is that Adam is our covenantal or federal head. that there is a covenant or a contract between us and Adam on the basis of which we are held responsible. That, I say, is a partial solution, because we still have to answer the question, how did Adam become my representative? Because I certainly never signed a contract with Adam. If I had the opportunity, I don't know about you, but if I had the opportunity to reject Adam's sin, I would most certainly do it. I just don't want it. But I never had that opportunity. So, you know, what I'm driving at here is any theory of justice that views human freedom or ability as fundamental to guilt is not able to answer this question. It is not able to answer the question of how did Adam justly become my representative? Because clearly, he was my representative before I was born, you know, from the very start. So how do we explain this problem? Well, I think there's only one solution, and that is that God, as the creator of law and justice, ultimately gets to decide who is guilty. As a corollary to that, he can appoint legal representatives if he wants to. He can create a contract between us and Adam, or between us and Christ, which seems to be an accurate description of what happened according to the Bible. He can create a covenant or a contract if he wants to, and we don't have to sign it for us to be responsible to keep it, or to be responsible on the basis of it. And then lastly, this is just because God has called it just. Not because there's an external standard of justice to God, but rather because God, as the creator of justice, gets to decide what he calls justice. And he said that he's the just and the justifier. So, you know, on the basis of God's decision, you know, we have to abide by that. So, he gets to decide. This, I believe, is a complete and I think the only solution to the problems surrounding original sin. Otherwise, on any other standard of justice, you will arrive at a problem of the transfer of guilt. So that concludes my comments. Does anybody else have anything to say? Yes.
Comment. You seem to be calling us to consistency. Most of us in this room have no problem whatsoever in claiming salvation based on God's sovereign choice.
Right.
We do have the problem of claiming our guilt on God's sovereign choice. And you're saying that you can't have it both ways.
Exactly.
And sometimes it's a lot easier to back into the guilt through that logic than it is to start with the guilt head on.
Right. It's true. This was all for a purpose, you know. It was for the purpose of then saving the elect. Because first he had to make everybody guilty and everybody corrupt. This is how he decided to do it. But that wasn't the end goal. Like, the end goal was always redemption. So, yeah, I think
for his own purposes. And when we studied covenants, we studied the idea, and we agree with the idea that he's imposed the covenants.
Right.
And we didn't have any problem with that.
The idea of transcendence, right? Usually how it's said in terms of, like, the Theos acronym. The first one is transcendence. God makes the covenant, right?
Right. And taking off from Meredith Klein's work on the covenants imposed in the Middle East, when a conquering nation would make its treaty with the conquered, they would impose a covenantal arrangement. We're going to protect you, and we're going to uphold these laws, but if you break this law, you're going to pay. And blah, 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 and so on and so on. And that was imposed. It's not like the conquered had much negotiating at the table there. You know, they were completely subjected. And that's where we find ourselves in relationship to God. We are completely subject to his desires. So he imposes the covenant. So we didn't have any problem with that. It's just this idea of the guilt where we want to... It's interesting that we want to hang on to our guilt personally. through our free will. That we, or maybe it's the reverse, that we want to hang on to our free will through guilt. It's interesting.
Yeah, but what happens is if you throw out the idea of... If you say that your guilt is based on something you did yourself, then you're stuck with that, and you can't get your guilt transferred to Christ. If you accept that, well, you get Adam's guilt, and now you can't get rid of it. But if you accept that guilt can be transferred, by God's sovereign choice, then you can not only can you get the guilt, you can get rid of it too. So that seems like I'd rather go that way. But
my question: What about our sins of commission? The sins that we actually commit, we're guilty for those too, right?
Right. That's...
What's your point?
Simply that we do incur guilt on our own.
Right.
And that's why I said in the passage, the much more is grace because, it was through one offense that we all became guilty, but the justification is of many offenses. It wasn't just the original sin, it's all our actual sins too. So that's one reason why... One sense, I guess, in which grace is a lot bigger, according to Paul, and a lot better because it takes care of everything, not just that one. Back at the garden.
It seems to me that this view then, you're always wrestling with the idea if God causes evil, then God must be guilty. And it's not fair for God to hold me responsible for Adam's sin. I know I've gotten this conversation with folks already, and I've asked a question. Okay, we're going to make you Adam now. God's not fair for, we know this, God's not fair for charging me with guilt for what Adam did. Not fair. Okay. Okay, we're going to make you Adam now. We're going to put you in the garden with Eve. Can you guarantee me that you wouldn't have done what Adam did? And the answer is always, well, no, I can't. I might have done the same thing. Well, do you know that you wouldn't have done the same thing? So it kind of comes back down to we call God not fair, but then we really don't have a basis for doing that based on what we do all the time anyway. Mm-hmm.
Switching to subject a little, why do you think it says in the one passage there, all men? Instead of the elect or something like that.
Right.
Well, let me flip back to that. We didn't talk about this one in our free will text, but and which one is it here? Even so, by the righteousness of one, the free gift came upon all men unto justification. If you're a universalist and you believe everyone gets saved, this is one of your primary texts. Why does he say that? Well, first, before I answer why he says that, let me just emphasize that it can't mean all in the same sense as the first one. They can't be the same in their extent. And because if you believe in that, you're going to have to believe that all men are actually justified and that justification results in life. So you have to believe in full, complete universalism, that God saves everybody. And that is clearly inconsistent with the rest of the Bible. I'm not going to get into a defense of that, but very clear that you cannot believe. If you go that route, you have to accept that all men are saved and all men are justified. Okay. Here's why I think that he used the word all. He's trying to the analogy that he's trying to get at is that it happened in the same way. So I think he's using the same form of language in both because of that. He's trying to not detract from the idea of justification and original sin happening in the same way by using a diversity of language between the two clauses. I think that's probably the reason that he uses all, in that instead of many or something like that, just because he's trying to preserve the similarity. In Corinthians, you have a similar verse that says, as in Adam all die, so in Christ are all made alive. If you want an explanation of the term all, what does all mean then here, if it doesn't mean everybody? You could say that as by the offense of one, judgment came upon all men that ended up dying to condemnation. And then, even so, by the righteousness of one, the free gift came upon all men who are actually, you know, justified unto life, or all men that it applied to. You know, technically speaking, all in the first clause doesn't mean all, because you do have Christ, who didn't die for his own sins, and didn't die. I mean, he did die for the sin of Adam by imputation, but it's a little bit different of a scenario. He didn't die for his... the offense didn't get transmitted to him. He didn't have original sin. So even the first one is not technically all. I think all he's trying to get across is that the processes are the same, and we shouldn't get tied up in the language. I don't know if that's satisfactory. Maybe somebody else has a better way of terming that. But
I agree with you that we need to go to the rest of the Bible for our support here, because in both of these verses, he uses all men for condemnation, all men in verse 18. Then he says, by one man's disobedience, many were made sinners, whereas we believe all were made sinners.
Right.
And so he uses all in all, and then many in many, because that's not the point he's trying to get across, is who. That's made, those arguments are made elsewhere.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. He's the one and the many and the all are all kind of used interchangeably here, because it's not the point of the passage. Right.
All to condemnation, all to justification in 18, many to disobedience, many righteous in 19. Mm-hmm. It's just parallel language.
Yeah.
But this is one of the primary texts of someone who would want to disagree with Calvinism. A lot of people use this text, you know, who wouldn't go the whole way and say, and accept universalism. So they say, well, here, this proves, you know, that Christ died for all men. But notice it says, all men unto justification of life. Like, you can't just go halfway, which is what a lot of people want to do. So I would just say, if you're gonna go that route, just realize you're going to end up a total, ultimate redemption of everybody. Which, to think that, to argue that that was what Paul had in mind here, in light of all the other things he's arguing in the book of Romans, is almost ludicrous.
This is also used by the unlimited atonement, the 4-point Calvinists, or 4.5-point Calvinists.
Right. The problem is, it doesn't say just justification. It says justification of life. Like, we actually have, it's not that Christ made provision for everybody, like they say, but that everybody's actually, all the all, are actually getting life. Yeah. So, in the final lesson, then, we're going to take these concepts. We've already introduced, you know, the idea of atonement as being parallel now to original sin. The problems of atonement, the justice of atonement, are fundamentally the same as the problems of original sin, because we have a guilt transfer. So the next time, we'll be looking at specifically atonement in light of these principles.